Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TeamCast. I am Dr. Preston Klein, Director of Research and Education at the Mission Critical Team Institute. The TeamCast is a show where my colleagues discuss all things mission critical teams. Mission critical teams are teams of 4 to 12 people who are indigenously trained and educated and who solve rapidly emerging complex adaptive problem sets. MCTs work in immersive environments of 300 seconds or less, where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. Regardless of whether you are a mission critical team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the TeamCast. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the TeamCast. This is Dr. Preston Klein. I am here today with a good friend of mine, Deputy Chief Michelle Fitzsimmons from the FDNY, the Fire Department of New York. Interestingly enough, New York is one of the few departments around the world where the fire department becomes before the city. Most other places, it's Orange County Fire, Austin Fire. FDNY is one of the few that's a fire department of New York. It has to do with how they were founded way back when. I'll introduce Michelle in a second, but what I want to do first is that we've had some folks from the FDNY on here before. And the reason I am sort of obsessed with them and keep bringing them on is because the FDNY is unique in many ways for mission critical teams and history. FDNY is unique in a number of different ways. And we'll talk about some of those around mission critical teams. One of the ways that seems, it doesn't seem to be a big deal, but it actually turns out to be a quite big deal is they all eat together. So firehouses eat together and the way they train and the generations after generations that come up. In a moment, we'll talk about the fact that Michelle's great-grandfather and grandfather and sister are all in the FDNY. And that's not as uncommon as you think. But the FDNY itself, just so you know, got started before New York was New York, when it was still a Dutch colony. 1648, it was a volunteer force, and they imported stuff from London, and they were fighting fires in a burgeoning little sort of basically town and then grow to be a city. By the time it gets to a little bit after the Civil War, so 1865, they've got returning soldiers, some of them highly decorated firefighters from New York, had fought in the Civil War as part of the New York contingents, and they come back and they need a job. So New York made the FDNY a professional firefighting service July 31st in 1865, which means that tomorrow, as we are recording this, will be the 160th anniversary of them becoming a professional firefighting organization. Now, why am I bringing all this up? Because they currently have grown to about 11,000 firefighters. But of those 11,000 firefighters, only 177 of them are currently women. About 1%. And part of that is because women were not allowed to join the fire department until about 1982, when 42 women passed through probie school. When I say probie school, that's the term that they give to their cadets or their new folks that have been hired and gone through their paramilitary training at Randall's Island in New York. And so that sort of fast forwards here brings us up to 2001, when Michelle Fitzsimmons joins the FDNY. But prior to that, I'm going to now welcome Michelle onto the program and ask her to tell us a little bit what it was like thinking about deciding to become a firefighter when her grandfather and great-grandfather were already firefighters. So Michelle, welcome to the TeamCast, and I'm delighted to have you here.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Preston. Always good to see you. Really, since we go back quite a bit, it's always been fun having these conversations, and when I get to see you, it's been a pleasure for me.
That's nice of you to say.
I worked with people with HIV and AIDS starting in 1991, and I had been completely burnt out by the time I had started looking at changing careers, and had thought about something that wasn't office driven and not deadlines and all sorts of stuff that kind of really did not work to my strength.
And can I just interrupt you just for a second? Yeah. So 1981, HIV AIDS, you're probably in the middle of it, just getting off, just starting to be understood during that.
No, 91. So we're 10 years into it. And it's still at that point, still kind of new drugs were still coming out. AZT was a new drug relatively. And, I did have a large turnover in my client base at that time because of the people passing away. And, things were really still very, it was a very different disease back then. Now it's become more manageable. Still a deadly disease, but a lot more manageable than it was at that time.
But it's a lot of trauma to over and over again lose patients, lose your usual clientele. And so you started to look for a new career. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Something better. No. And, you know, something that could be a little more worked my strengths, I think. And I happened to be out at a fundraiser and sitting at a table talking about looking at the police department. And, you know, I talked about when I was a kid, I thought about the fire department. And I happened to be sitting next to one of the women who was the original women in the fire department. Brenda Berkman happened to be sitting at the table. And she just like kind of chatted a little bit. And she mentioned, you know, I think there should be a test coming up soon. And I was like, oh, this was in 98. So it was like early 98. She said the sign up was going to be coming soon. And it did, came around in September of 98. I signed up for the exam.
And for our audience, and when she's saying exam, this is a civil service exam. So
civil service exam. Yeah. So civil service exam, you had to be between the ages of 17 and a half, and you couldn't be 29 on the day that the filing opened. I was a month and a half from being too old. So I kind of got in the nick of flick and was able to take the sign up for the written exam, took the written exam in 99. And in 2000, like I scored well, I got 100. I had city residency that helped me. And in 2000, I took a took the physical and then ended up on a list. I think my list number was higher than 300. I don't remember exactly what it was. But that made me get into the second class of open competitive firefighters.
Was that?
May of 2001.
So May of 2001. So sort of an historical time. We've had folks on the show that were in special operations training in the spring and summer of 2001. And so they would be the first generation going into it. So when do you graduate probie school?
Well, we were supposed to graduate. We're out in the field on the 4th of July weekend was when we finished our first 8 weeks of probie school. We were supposed to go out to the field for 14 weeks, doing seven weeks in an engine, 7 weeks in a truck, do a cross-training type of thing, and also for them to assess how well are the probies retaining their training when they go out in the field. And then the idea was you were going to go back to the academy for some final testing before they sent you out to the field and had your assignment. So it would have been probably sometime in, say, 9/7/16. It probably would have been around the first week of September that we actually would have graduated and had a graduation. But actually, no, a little later than that. We were 9 weeks into that training. So 9 weeks into 14 weeks of training on September 11th.
Yep. And we're...
And pretty much everything changed after that. It shifted the whole trajectory of what our academy was supposed to be. It changed it from being that 14 weeks in the field. We ended up staying in the field for another till I think November 1st or somewhere around there that we actually had a graduation ceremony. It was somewhere in there. So it was a big difference. I entered the department with it being one way. And 9 weeks into my being out in the field, it shifted into something else.
And then
face of the department.
Where were you on the day of 9/11? Like, what was that first 36 hours like for you?
I was actually off duty that morning. I was actually out giving out. I was polling for someone for the primary elections that day.
Yeah,
I had been out giving out some flyers, and then came home, was sitting in my car in the driveway when I happened to be, I just put a new radio in my car, is programming radio stations. And I happened to have, had K-Rock on, which is where Howard Stern was broadcast in New York. Wasn't something I normally listened to, and basically had him say, plane just crashed into the World Trade Center. And whoever he was talking to said something along the lines of, that's not funny. He said, no, it actually is. And I came into the house, turned the TV on, just about on time to be sitting there and watching things kind of unfold. and then saw the second plane hit. Grabbed my gear. I didn't have my gear, was at the firehouse, but I had brought all my uniforms home to clean them. Grabbed those and went into Coney Island. Drove into Coney Island. I think I was, by the time I got into Coney Island, because some of the roads were, I think I was taking the belt. And for some reason, traffic was completely stopped. So I jumped off, took a kind of bypassed that area, and I got in there. Both towers had collapsed by the time I got there.
Yeah.
To the firehouse. And then I think we were down at the World Trade Center. We commandeered a city bus, and we were there around 11 o'clock that morning.
And then how long were you there before you were able to get?
I think I got back to Brooklyn around 2 a.m.
Okay.
We head back. I got back to the firehouse after that, and they told me that they had changed to an A-B shift. We'd be working 24-hour shift, 24 on, 24 off. They told me I was in the morning, and they were like, so just stay. And I was like, no, I need to go home. I just in my head, I was like, I can't be here right now. I just need to go home. And drove home. I think I slept for maybe a couple hours, got back in my car, and was back in the firehouse, I think at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. And you and I have talked, but Michelle and I have known each other since about 2010 or 11. And so we've had a chance to talk about some of this stuff over the years, but some of your peers in Proby school were killed that day. And yeah. So when did you start finding out that information?
I worked that next day. It was either that day or 48 hours later, because it would have been, I remember going to the next firehouse over, had the battalion, and I remember going there, and it was like a list getting passed around of like the missing. And at that, you know, it was a very preliminary list. And I remember thinking, well, I just got on the job. You guys are going to know more than me, you know. And since we were so new, actually, I think like the contact with some of the guys was a little loose. And I think originally there were more than just what ended up being the six guys who died from my class at that time. There were some additional people. I remember seeing their names as well. But I was shocked. You know, it was like one of these things. You're like, wow, I was thinking, oh, it's not going to be my guys. But the guy next to me in Proby school, Mike Dioria, he was killed. Andy Brunn was also in my squad in Proby school. He was also killed that day, as well as Charlie Anaya, Anthony Rodriguez, Richie Allen, Michael Camarada. Michael Camarada was one of the youngest firefighters killed that day. He was just 21 years old. And they, all of them had gotten on. We were the last group to get out of Proby school that actually lost people that day.
Got it. So prior to this, over the years, you and I have talked about your grandfather and your great-grandfather and their views about you joining the FDNY. And I think initially, maybe not so much in favor. Is that true?
My great-grandfather had died when I was 3. So okay. He really didn't have an opinion about it.
Yeah.
But my grandfather, I remember seeing the news when women got into the fire department in 1982. I was 13 at the time. And I remember my grandfather said, you know, I remember saying, ooh, and my grandfather saying, women, you know, I think he probably said, girls shouldn't be firefighters.
Yeah.
And I pretty much was like, oh, okay. You know, the chief has spoken because he had been a battalion chief. And I was like, okay. And I really kind of pushed it out of my mind and didn't think about it again until much later, like when I just happened to be looking for another career. So it came back around, but it was a very long time before it came around again.
What was his sort of thinking? How did he evolve in his thinking?
Well, let's see. You'd have to think. He retired in 1968.
Yeah.
He came on in 1932. He retired in 1968. And he came from a very different generation of firefighters. And I think once I started talking about having taken the written exam, doing the physical exam, passing the physical exam with 100, and all of this, these things that kind of went on, I think he was an old man at that point.
Yeah.
And he shifted his, you know, and could see how excited I was about it.
Yeah.
and it shifted. And then when I brought him to family day, which they do at the academy, the weekend before you kind of go out to the field, they have family day, and I brought him. He came to that, and he was very excited to be there and very excited to be, you know, watching how much the department had changed.
Yeah.
I was very grateful that he was around for that. He ended up he died, I think, the month I got off probation. So he died a year after.
Okay.
September 11th actually had a pretty devastating effect on him. Like, he was an old man who was watching the news, and you could see that it really destroyed him seeing how many firefighters were killed. And I think it brought back a lot of things for him.
Yeah.
A lot of the trauma, a lot of the residue, right? That we talk about.
Oh, absolutely. And so as a firefighter, you had joined the department thinking you were going to join a certain FDNY in 9/11, as we've talked about, right? Mm-hmm. Became a very different fire department in many ways. Some ways, mm-hmm. not at all, but in some ways, very different.
Yeah.
So what was that first year like? I mean, I'm sure that the events of 9/11 probably overshadowed everything, but there were still fires going on. There were still things happening in the city. So what was it like being a brand new firefighter in that dynamic, especially with all the promotions? So there was probably a lot of turnover as well.
There was, you know, that was the thing. It was you were walking into this department originally, you know, like, hey, you know, this is, it was fun and exciting. And there was really an overshadowing of grief and trauma of what everyone had been through.
Yeah.
And it was the funerals, right? The funerals, the memorials, that was like an everyday thing of going to funerals and memorials at the very beginning. So it was a very different introduction than what previous generations had dealt with.
Yeah.
And I think we are, like, definitely things have changed, but it was this very shifting, guys getting promoted quickly, unexpectedly too. Like, you know, it wasn't, guys had a, you know, you kind of have this trajectory, like, oh, I'm here on the list, it's going to be about that much time. You had guys who were like, I'm what? I'm getting promoted this weekend? What? You know, that original group that they did, what was it, the Saturday, I think, after September 11th, when they did that mass promotion.
Yeah.
You know, we had guys who were just like, oh, you know, you're kind of pulling guys out of their safe space and going through that kind of trauma. So I think our experience was very different. I was fortunate. I had officers who were very much, when I was down in Coney Island, TKO, Tom Owens, was the captain of 166, which was where I was working at the time. I did my first 7 weeks in 318, and then I went across to Florida, 166. And he was very much committed to, you're the probie, you still have to learn. Like, he was still drilling. Like, he still wanted to drill. He didn't want me going down to the World Trade Center as much as the other guys. He wanted me riding on the rig and learning the job. And then I got to when they actually eventually did do a graduation ceremony and we got our assignments, and I was assigned to 280 Engine 289 in Corona. I had really good officers. I had great officers who were very committed to training their firefighters. And, you know, I had Rick Bruno was forever will be, you know, kind of Mr. Calm, cool, and collected, no matter how crazy things were going. He was that lieutenant that I really modeled a lot of how I wanted to be in the department after him. Pete Mulhall was the captain of 289 at the time. Also just, you know, a soft-spoken, but good leader. You know, so I was very fortunate. I ended up in a place with that. I ended up in a place that had a lot of senior members who really were committed to the tradition of the department and being an engine firefighter.
Yeah. So now that you've had some time on the job and you look back on those days, is there a few things that you can pull out that made those leaders such good leaders? Is there, besides the sort of soft-spoken, calm, focused on training, are there other aspects that just stood out for you that you still think about as emulating what good leadership is, in your opinion?
I think they led by example, right? Like, they were, like, what they spoke was what they were. they didn't, it wasn't like a, this is for you, this is for me. How they, what they expected is what the, their expectations were of themselves as well as their members.
Yeah.
I think that's an important part of it. They, like, people would just kind of pull you aside and ask you questions and make, like, and he would ask me questions. I'd just be like, huh? He'd be like, do you have any questions about that? And I like, I'd always be like, I need a little bit of time to think about it. Like, I, and it was, they did that. They also, like, I remember seeing discipline that happened that wasn't, there was never like a calling someone out on the carpet in front of others in a way that would have kind of knocked them down.
Yeah.
I did, I remember seeing discipline carried out that was fair, addressed the issue, and was done in a way that respected who they were.
It's interesting, and one of the reasons I bring it up is because the FDNY, because, you know, in the years that I've been watching it, it's grandfathers, fathers, sons, daughters, right? And now, yeah. And what it's interesting is that in the world right now, you have some debates around people like Steve Jobs, who was kind of a jerk personally, but got things done. And so, like, I was a great leader. And it's an interesting thing because when I talk to folks in the military or fire or police, this concept of the end justify the means usually doesn't survive the culture. Meaning, like, if you're not role modeling what you believe others should be doing in behavior, action, and words, it's probably not going to work out for you. And I didn't know if that's true in your opinion or if you have other thoughts.
I think there have been people, like, I can look at some of the leaders who I don't think were great leaders. And it really was, like, I remember one, I will not name names, but one specifically kind of like saying, yeah, I know there's all these ideas about leadership and stuff, but I don't really like cater to that approach.
Yeah.
And I had already been pretty clear that I didn't think this person was a good leader. And that just really nailed home exactly where their shortcomings were,
yeah.
Right? They, like, I understand that that might be a way to do it, but that's not what, my way. And I've never responded well. And I haven't seen many people who do respond well to that bullying as a leadership style.
Yeah. I also just
think, I respect most are the ones who kind of lead by example, are clear in what they're, they hold a vision of what the way things should be. And I think they are good at kind of steering things towards that and maintaining that leadership.
I also think, I agree with that. And I also think that those people, and we've talked a lot about this, they have weaponized their curiosity. So while they have a vision, they've also remained curious. Mm-hmm. Where I often have found I struggle is when people are certain with a big C. They are like, they know the way, you can't dissuade them otherwise. They are not open to new ideas. And they, if you just shut up and listen to them, they'll tell you the right way to do things.
Mm-hmm.
That innate lack of curiosity is especially on mission critical teams where you're so engaged with uncertainty, that's a very kind of a dangerous place to be. You need to have a vision, you need to have direction, you need to be able to move forward, but you also need to be open up to new ideas and new emergent things.
Mm-hmm. I can point to specific examples of being on the fire ground and having probies point stuff out to me. Like, hey, do you think, like, the stuff that was really important. I remember we were standing on a stairwell. It was I think it might have gone to a third alarm in an old law tenement. The fire had started in a shaft and we were on the stairs and there was a tiny little hole in the plaster next to us that had smoke pushing out of it and like the tiniest little wisp of smoke. And he went, Do you see that? I was like, oh. And it basically what he was seeing was the fire was in the shaft next to us and had started communicating into this wall that we were standing next to, which was the primary means of egress for everybody operating above us.
Yeah.
Right. And like that, like I've always said to, like, when I was a captain, I always said it to my probies. When I was a lieutenant, always like, if you see something, if you have something to say, say it, right? Because, you know I can't see everything. I don't know everything. And having those conversations where you are open to hearing things and you respond to it, I think makes a big difference.
So I'm going to take a second here because this was, for those of you who don't fight fires, I don't fight fires. And so the first time that John Regan brought me to the FDNY and introduced me to Dominic Bertucci, and Dominic put all the bunker gear on me and the masks, and they lit a room on fire. And they said, we're going to crawl into this room. And I was pretty excited because I was thinking it was going to be like the movies and there would be a picture of me in this fire room. And I'm pretty excited. And it was a level of darkness that is hard to really understand. I actually put my hand to my mask and could not see my hand. And so I wondered if you would take a minute to just talk about, like, describe for somebody who's never been in it, what being in a raging fire is actually like.
I'd say early on, I can say it was crawling around in utter chaos, having no idea where I was, holding onto a hose line, having my officer go, okay, open it up, opening the line up, putting out a room of fire, having no clue what they were looking at and pointing me towards, and having it go out and walking outside and doing like the high fives and having no idea what had transpired. No idea how much time had gone by, no idea that I was actually in a room that was on fire. It could have been Shea Stadium. It could have been a closet. I had no idea how big the room was. My perspective was awful. I, too, had probably school, you get a little bit of experience because, you know, you do go into fires and stuff. But my first actual fire, I was clueless.
Yeah.
And I basically came out, I was like, woohoo, that was great, I guess. Over time, it's still kind of a lot of organized chaos. Like, there is always that element of you don't know the exact layout of the room. You don't know the exact placement of furniture. You don't know exactly where everyone is around you. You don't always know exactly who it is who's around you. You know there are other people in the room with you. So there, like, it's this experience of, like, when people come out and they, like, have this very detailed, exact thing about it, I'm always kind of like, huh. That's really impressive.
Yeah.
I've gotten, over time, 24 years of doing it, I actually do feel like I can go into most often, I'm not going to curse myself and say that always, where, yeah, it's pitch black in there. You're going to stay close to a wall. You're going to stay close to your landmark. You're going to have these landmarks that you're going to kind of map in your head. You're going to create this internal map as you're moving through a space of where you are. But I always go in afterwards to take a look and see what the room looks like. And often it's, you know, the map I had in my head would have gotten me out of the room. The map in my head might help me search and make sure I've checked for everything. But I usually have no idea exactly what that room looked like.
Yeah. So I always, when I'm ever interviewing firefighters, I always ask two questions. I'm going to ask them to you now. And the first is, how hot is hot? And how did you figure that out?
I can remember the first time figuring out how hot was, it was the second fire we had gone to that. I was working in Corona. It was the second fire we had gone to that day because our officer had gone on medical leave from the first fire. So we had one of our senior members riding up front as the officer. So I was backing up. Steve Poppy was on the nozzle. I was backing him up. Jimmy Weldon was acting officer. And pretty much we start moving in, and we're moving in, and it's pitch black, and we could see that this is a fire we could see from three blocks away of the cloud of smoke going up, and we're moving in. And as we're moving in, all of a sudden I'm like, oh boy, is my back getting hot. I was like, my back getting very hot. And I remember hitting Steve on the back and being like, I think we passed the fire. And we had gone down we had kind of veered off down a hallway, and it was actually in a room next to us. And that was kind of my first time of being like, yep, that was hot. Yep, my back got hot. And I definitely didn't want to keep going in the direction we were going.
Yeah.
And it pretty much was when I could feel the heat start coming through my jacket, you know, my coat, and And I started to think, I might actually get burned. That was hot. And it's, you know, it's definitely not, the one time I got a burn, it was a tiny little burn from an ember that fell on the back of my neck. And even that, I didn't even realize I was burnt until about 2 hours later.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, my first experience of that was hot.
And the previous
fire I'd gone to, there was no even assessment of, oh, it's hot in here.
Yeah.
You know, because you're so bunkered up. And
how has your relationship changed with hot over the years?
I definitely, having gone through different ranks, I have a different perspective of it's not just where I am, it's also where everyone else is, right? Like where I am is hot, where is everyone else in this space? And I think I have seen people come out of fires with helmets that were charred, eye shields that were melted, coats that were discolored from it being too hot. And I think I've definitely started to think a little more conservative in what I assess of what is too hot, right? I think the danger of people getting burned, especially how much we're bundled up now. Like that's the thing is the hoods we have are thicker than the hoods we had when I first came on.
Yeah.
The gear has a vapor shield now. Like things of, you know, the bunker gear has just gotten thicker. It's getting laundered more often, so it's got more fluff in it. It offers more insulation. So it definitely, I think I'm more conservative in terms of what I consider hot now.
Yeah. When I was a wilderness guide leading expeditions, one of the common things you'll hear guides say is the 5 times rule. So if you're cold or hot or thirsty or hungry, your participants are 5 times worse because you're used to it. And so you're always in the back of your mind, if you're starting to feel a sensation, like what should trigger is, oh, I got to look around because my people are probably actually in trouble. If I'm starting to notice it, it means that they've noticed it for a while.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll say that the fire I went to last night, it was very much in my mind of it was hot, it was humid, the quality of air was poor, and I was showing up and definitely aware of we need to get these units relieved.
Yeah.
Like, because it's not just the temperature of the room they're in, it's their temperature.
Yeah.
Right. They're closed up, they've got all this gear on, and their temperature of being able to get cooled down. When you're in an environment like that, you know, and you're working hard, that's the other thing, working hard. It's not just what's around them. Like, it's not the fire necessarily that I'm concerned about now. Now I'm concerned about someone going into rhabdo, like getting overheated or too dehydrated. You know, it's more the care of the members as their physical health and not just for burns.
Yeah.
But
when I went out and visited you a few weeks ago, and you were gracious enough to allow me and my team, Randall's Island was gracious enough to allow me and my team to experience some of the training evolutions, and they put us in a bit of a burn building. But what's interesting about that is that on its face, it's really interesting. But what I have to remind people is it was a 96 degree day. Mm-hmm. So you're putting on what's basically a snowmobile suit. I mean, a snowmobile suit with thick gloves, a hood, thick boots, a helmet and a mask. So you're closing in all your skin and you're just baking in 96 degrees. And then they put you in a fire. And so
they ask you to do physical
stuff, right? Yeah. So the first time I did that years ago, I remember like taking off my boots and I had sweated through, my boots had filled with water. Like at the time from sweat. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. So the thing that I think people often forget with firefighters and police officers is that it doesn't matter if it's 104 degrees or minus 40 degrees, you still got to do the thing you got to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that was that I feel now has become, as having been a battalion chief and now a deputy chief, Yeah, I'm thinking about the environment they're operating in, but I'm also thinking about the members' physiology and their wellness. Everyone is always going to say, when you say, how are you guys doing? They're always going to say, we're good.
Yeah.
Because they're doers, right? They want to be in there. They want to be doing it. They don't want to, and they're not going to say, yeah, we need relief.
Yeah.
It's my job to say, yeah, you do. Like, I'll be like, how you doing? They'll be like, we're good. I'm like, you did a great job. Thank you very much.
Yeah. It's interesting how my language has changed, because I agree with you. I no longer ask, are you good or do you have enough water? Instead, I ask, how many times have you refilled your water bottle? Mm-hmm. That will tell me something, right? And if they're like, I don't remember, and I was like, yeah, that's a problem, right? Because you should remember.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, over time, like, I feel like now, like, and we've talked about this in the past, is like that blur of that mental performance, and when you kind of lose that time gets a little sticky and kind of weird. You know, things have changed on our job. Like, our job now, our dispatchers will announce when we're 20 minutes into the operation.
Yep.
Right? A very critical time if you have a building that's free burning. 15 minutes, you're starting to worry about collapse.
Yeah.
Things, right? In some of these buildings. So at 20 minutes, our dispatcher's saying, 20 minutes into the operation, right? We have an app on an iPad that is in our incident command app, where you can map the, you know, what units are on scene and all this stuff. And there's a running clock up in the corner of that.
And that 20 minutes could have gone by what felt like 2 hours or 2 seconds.
Exactly. Said last night, by the time I got there, they were announcing, you know, between when the initial, because it starts from when the initial phone call comes in.
Yep.
Oh, you add in the time it takes companies to get there, do an assessment. So a lot of times by the time I'm showing up now, we are approaching that 20 minute mark. But, you know, still for me, even when I'm not the one who's doing the physical work, it becomes more the mental mapping and understanding, you know, and trying to project out of what's going to, you know, where are we moving? What direction is this going? Still, I look down and I'm like, wow, hour and 12 minutes. Woo! That went
quick. That's my actually second question. So we talked about how hot is hot. Now I want to ask you, how long is 60 seconds?
60 seconds can be an eternity.
Yeah.
Or it could be the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
Right? There really is. It is so particular to the situation. You know, I've been at things where things seem to slow down, at those instances where everything just seems to slow down and stall. And then those things where you just like, I remember early on as a battalion chief being the fire sector and being in there and completely losing track. I had no idea. All I knew was after a while, all of a sudden it's like, oh, really tired, really hot, really tired. And I had been inside for like 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, running up and down, you know, going from one floor to another, up and back and forth and back and forth and checking in on the units and stuff. And I had no idea at all that much time had gone by.
So when I was doing my doctoral research, I sat you down and interviewed you. And one of the questions I asked you was, mm-hmm. How do you tell time in a fire? And I don't know if you remember your reply, but I will ask you now again, how do you tell time in a fire?
Back then, I know it had to do with kind of what my tasks were, right? With, you know, operating a hose line and, hey, there's an awful lot of water accumulating on this floor below me. We've been here for a while, right?
Yep.
You know, I'd see like how much water was there accumulating on the floor, gave me a good measure of how much time, how long it had been. Now I actually, because I'm removed and step back.
Yeah.
I use that clock.
Yeah.
Because I'm the one on scene who can do that.
Yeah.
Right? I know everyone else doesn't have that luxury to be able to look at that running clock of how long have we been operating. And that can tell me a lot about, like, last night, you know, we're putting our next one truck we had standing waiting. We put them to work. I immediately asked. I was like, we need another, let's get another truck because we're definitely going to need to relieve units again.
Yeah.
Based on where we are in this. So I will instead of being like, oh, I've got these fancy little things that I do now, I rely on what the application tells me of how long we've been operating.
Yeah. Well, I'll take you back. When you were starting out, how long was it before you realized that you needed some mechanism to gauge time?
I don't think it wasn't until I was an officer and realizing that I was responsible for other people.
Yeah.
Right? Because I was, as a firefighter, I was focused on myself and my task.
Yeah.
Right? I had my team members around me, definitely was part of it, but it wasn't until I was an officer, a company officer, as a lieutenant, that I am now responsible for, like, I'm not operating like they are. I need to keep track of how long we've been operating. I need to keep track of, are we making progress? I need to, you know, look out for the safety of my members, look out for the operational abilities. You know, after operating for a certain amount of time, it's a lot. You know, like it's exhausting work. If you're on air, you have a pretty clear way of knowing, right? You're going to start, your vibe alert's going to go off. Your mask is going to tell you you're running out of air. And that is a very clear indicator. But you're not always in a situation where you got your mask on still. You could be outside operating. You could be in a place where the smoke has lifted. And despite the fact that, I know Frank Lee would go ballistic that taking your mask off before all your overhaul is done. And, you know, we're definitely making movement towards trying to keep people with their mask on as long as possible to reduce our exposure to carcinogens and gases that we shouldn't be breathing that are doing damage to our, you know, our bodies and our hearts and our lungs. It's very easy when you're not wearing a mask and you have that restricted amount of air to operate with. It's very easy to lose track of that time.
Yeah. Just a note on that. A lot of people, including me, didn't realize or didn't make the connections that fighting fire in the 1800s, what's burning is wood and cloth and hay. Fighting a fire in 2025, what's burning is every kind of chemical that you can imagine and going into smoke that's quite harmful to humans and has lasting impacts on firefighter health. And I know it's being studied around the country, around the world right now.
And, you know, and even like what they use to as our fire retardants.
Yep.
They're off-gassing as well. It's really, you know, we are surrounded by petroleum-based products everywhere that just make fires burn hotter and more intense. And the smoke that we are in is just fuel. You know, we have this, you know, this fuel that surrounds us. And, you know, if it just gets to the right ignition temperature, we're be in a world of hurt from if we aren't watching for the signs that this is going to ignite.
Yep. What one of the other things I wanted to ask you is that when you think about an engine team or a ladder team, what I call a company, I call them a team, is what makes for a successful one?
I think having good communication and trust. First and foremost, I think trust. And it's that trust that everyone is there with a common purpose. I think that makes a big difference. And I think that gets built through training, the meals we have together, joining the department with the goal of being a part of something larger, something that gives a service to our community, a camaraderie amongst us of having this common goal of helping people, saving people. And it's not just a job. I think at times when we get away from the purpose of the job in our recruitment, I think, you know, when you just start talking about great job, great benefits, I think we start to drift away from the thing that gives us a uniting kind of rally,
yeah,
or things to rally around. But, you know, for me, even as a deputy chief coming, you know, bouncing around the city, being in the kitchen, having dinner, you know, I can think back to, you know, having two meals in a firehouse yesterday, that time of sitting with everyone and talking and sharing whatever it is, I've probably laughed harder in firehouse kitchens than I have anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
With some of the funny, you know, the sharing and the talking and but that building of team and feeling of belonging, I think that's, you know, an important part of the process.
Yep. Yeah. Our friend, Reverend Sue Phillips, talks about connection, belonging, and becoming as key parts of a team, right? That you need to be connected to somebody. You need to feel like you belong and you need to feel like you're learning something for you to stay. And I think a leader's job is often to make sure that all three of those things are getting met for each of the people that are there. So if you had to just generally say, I mean, you just spoke about it pretty in detail, but when you think about, because it is unique that firefighters eat together, what do you think that the primary purpose or one of the main purposes of eating together is? Because you prep the meal, you all go out, you shop for the meal, you prep the meal, cook the meal, you eat the meal, and you clean up after the meal.
Yeah. I used to do that. They don't really let me do that anymore.
Yeah.
Right. I just kind of, I come down to eat now. And, you know, anytime you try to get your hand, like there were times I'd be like, oh, I got that. And they'd be like, no. Like even the simplest little things, it's kind of ridiculous. But I think that time spent, like, you know, breaking bread together is an important thing. You know, that's your chance to get to know the people. That's a chance to connect. And I get to see also kind of I get to see who everyone is. I get to see where they fit in that,
yep,
that machine, right? What cog are they? How do they interact with each other? I think it's a great part of the job. And it also opens up that storytelling, right?
Yeah.
We learn from not just our own experiences going to fires and stuff, but we learn from hearing about other people's experiences.
Yeah.
And what it was like for them, right? We can't create the Wheelodex that we have in our brain of all the things that could happen.
Yeah.
But if we've sat in the kitchen and heard someone else talking about something, you might be able to kind of reach back and be like, hey, this sounds vaguely familiar, right? And you've now got this card that you can pull out and be like, oh, I think I know where this might go because I've heard about it before.
Yeah. So that you just a moment ago, you were referencing how when you go down to try to help out with the kitchen, they respectfully and kindly just say, wave you off. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because the FDNY, like the Marine Corps, like some other places, have very specific, informal, not really talked about rules about paying respect. It's sort of a New York thing, it's sort of an FDNY thing, but it's very much about making sure that if you walk into a room, that you're paying respect and respect is being paid. And it's one of those things that it took me a little while hanging out with you guys to understand that there's certain rituals, greeting rituals, and other things that really matter about how you talk to one another, who you defer to, these kind of things. That's not to say you can't speak truth to power. That's not what I'm talking about at all.
Right.
It's more of just the glue that keeps the culture moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still, like, I still have people be like, chief. And I'm like, come on. Like, you know me.
Yeah.
Like, you know me. Like, don't do that to me, you know, or like doing the saluting thing. But it is a sense, like, it does show respect. And while it makes me uncomfortable, I think at times I have to just appreciate it for what it is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, being in the department for 24 years, there are firefighters who I still look up to.
Yeah.
There are still firefighters that I look up to because they were firefighters when I got on this job. And they're still firefighters. And they have, in the role of firefighter, they'll probably see more of the red stuff than I did because I kind of diverted and went to different places. You know, I've worked with people who worked at really busy firehouses, and those guys are really have done all of it.
Yeah.
They've been through a lot. And, you know, so I think that respect that the senior firefighters in a firehouse get, it's important.
Yeah.
Right? Understanding that they've done, like, we've all gone through the same exact path. Right? I think that's one of the things that really gives credibility in our department our chief of department went through probie school. You know, he went through probie school. He was a firefighter. He was a lieutenant, captain. Like, he had to go through all the ranks to get there. He wasn't anointed with that. And I think you can look at any person as a chief. You know, you look and you go, well, they were a probie, firefighter. You know, they earned it. They worked their way through it, and they've gotten there.
Yeah.
So I think that you have that respect that is really, it is ingrained within our department.
Yeah. So as we start to sort of close this out, I could talk to you all day, of course, but I want to be respectful of your time and everyone else's time. You know, you've been now 24 years. You're the first deputy chief in the FDNY in its 160-year history. And if you were thinking about how firefighters changed in your time, but more specifically, I guess what I want to know is, and you can answer that question, but if you were speaking to somebody who was in your shoes 25 years ago, a young man or a young woman, what would you want for them? How would you go about sort of talking to them about joining the FDNY? Why would they join?
I think, you know, when I still look, I have the best job in the world. I found a career that I am so blessed that I never went to work and was really miserable. Or, you know, I never had that Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. I need to get up and go to work in the morning. Oh God, I really don't want that. I never had to deal with that. I became part of a team. I felt like I was operating in a capacity for like a greater good type of thing.
Yeah.
I had people who supported me. I found my allies. That's the other thing I tell people, find your allies, because we're not all the same. And some of us do struggle when we come into the department. It has not been all perfect the whole time. I've run into my challenges as a woman in the department. But I found allies. I found the people who backed me up. Fortunately, I was surrounded by a lot of those people in my career. And I think that makes a difference, is finding those people who are your allies. Have confidence in yourself. Have confidence in your competence. That's a big thing, because I know I spent a lot of time as a new firefighter beating myself up. Of any time I messed something up, I was going crazy. Like, oh my gosh, I screwed up. And focusing on that way too much instead of just letting it go, learn from it, and move on. But the being part of a team that I was able to find allies in, even when I had a couple people, and it was very few people, but they can sometimes, those people who kind of really kind of fight against you a bit, sometimes that even though it's only one, sometimes that squeaky wheel really does get a lot of your focus and attention.
100%.
Yep. Right.
And I think it's true for any human, right? Is that
I absolutely.
You can have 100 people that are on your side, but if one is out to get you or doesn't like you for whatever reason, it fills your windshield. It's hard to see anything else.
Right. And that's if you get those allies around you, those people who have that same approach, you know, that you connect with, and have them use them as your soundboard and your echo chamber that you might need to kind of get past those people.
So of the original 42 women in 1982, you were the seventh one to join after that.
Yep. Yeah. I was only the seventh. For early on in my career, there were 33 women for a very long time.
Yeah.
Get another woman, another would retire. Like, there really was this, like, the single replacement going for a very, like, I could say it was probably, I think it was like 5 or 6 years where it was still just 33 women.
Yeah.
That number stayed low for a long time. And then fortunately it did open up after September 11th, after that initial list that I had been on, the next list after that, EMS promotions, the number of women has started to pick up. It's still ridiculously low when you consider the size of the department.
Yeah.
Not many.
If you were a young woman now, would you recommend joining the FDNY?
I would, absolutely.
Okay.
I absolutely would. I loved it. I have helped some women who have had struggles and talked to them about what are their options. One woman who I know, like I was, once in a while, I am shocked that you still think it was like the 1970s based on how some people approach things, but definitely was able to help facilitate addressing those issues.
Yeah. Right,
and kind of move on that. And as I said, you know, the thing is to find your allies, find those people who lift you up, not those people who pull you down.
Yeah. And then not to be controversial, but the other challenge that's faced with any group who is in such small numbers is that if one of those members are not operating great, it puts you in a very difficult position, because if they're not performing to your satisfaction, you're caught, because there's so few of you, you don't want to be the person that attacks them. At the same time, they still have to meet the standard. Have you come across that?
You are held to a higher standard.
Yeah.
You are the minority, whether you're a person of color or a woman. You are going to be held to a standard that is different, right? It's like that, the jar of marbles, that whole thing of like, you basically show up with an empty jar.
Yeah.
And everything you do is when you get your, you know, the marbles get dropped in. A straight white man walk into the firehouse, he's already got a jar of marbles he's showing up with.
Yeah.
And they're kind of pulling marbles out when he messes up. But when you are, you know, a woman or a person of color coming in, a lot of times your jar is already empty.
Yeah.
So anything that you do wrong, you don't have, you know, you have nothing there.
Yeah.
There's nothing in reserve that they think that you might have. And it's a very unfortunate circumstance. And I like to hope that it's shifting.
Yeah.
That everyone kind of comes in with as many marbles in their jar as the other people.
Yeah.
So that it's not, you don't just build, you know, you're not building from scratch. The expectation is that you are competent. You're coming out, you're competent. And if you stumble here and there, it's not a complete failure that you are not capable.
Yeah.
You know, you're learning. That's every team like this, you have a learning curve.
Yeah.
There are going to be errors made. You're going to learn from them. You know, after action reviews that we did with the ventures, like that's something that is such a valuable tool of being able to have people speak honestly about what was their intention, where might they do better next time, to honestly assess their own performance and look at improving it. Whereas if all you're doing is criticizing someone where it doesn't feel like they can come back from that.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough. And I think that's the issue, that people who are the smaller group, you know, you stand out.
Yeah. And you were referencing the Wharton Leadership Ventures for folks that are listening in. And that's an exercise where we bring a group of MBAs, or what I used to do, they still do it, bringing MBAs to the Rock, Randall's Island, to do some period of training with the FDNY. And what's lovely about that experience is I think sometimes the instructors learn as much from the students as the students do from the instructors. And so
absolutely,
a lovely exchange.
Yeah. And, no, I think it's been a great tool, I think, for the instructors to really hone the skills at doing those after action reviews.
Yeah. I think, you know, just to balance out, maybe it's not necessary, but just to put this in perspective, is that when you're talking about the jars, and it's interesting because I think about all that stuff and all the institutional historical baggage that comes with all that stuff. And I think about what you said about allies. And so just this notion that it's no longer easy anywhere to paint big brushes on things, because you've got the stereotypes still today in any organization. And more you've got folks that kind of recognize the need for different voices and who are going to act as champions. And so I guess what I would say is that, and I'm saying this for you, so you push back, but I think one of the reasons that you would, when I asked you if you think young women should join the FDNY, is because there are champions within the organization and there are folks they're gonna advocate for them. And that isn't to say there aren't challenges to overcome, but it's to say it is not a universal that the opposition is not universal, but rather it's in pockets, and that there are also pockets of allies and champions. Is that fair?
I think we have more champions and allies than we do. Yeah. The critical people who are so critical. Like, I've been fortunate. Many of the leaders in the department have been those allies and the people, my cheerleaders, people who've encouraged me. You know, I can say Jack Hodgins and I crossed paths years ago, and he was always like someone who I felt was a supporter. I was fortunate enough to work at headquarters when John Esposito came and took over operations and got to work with him there. And I feel like he has been open to hearing things that I have to say and really supportive of women in the department. And like, what are the things we need to help? Like, we've started, there's been this whole start of bunker gear specifically for women.
Yeah.
Right. And like a small thing that, you know, we're the largest department in the country. We should at least have women the option to have bunker gear that's tailored for women.
We've heard that in the military for women's body armor, that men's body armor obviously doesn't fit them. And mm-hmm. It becomes actually a really critical issue. And so that in law enforcement, and I know there are efforts to try to do that. And people, the American citizens expect that the people that are in service to them look like them. And mm-hmm. that's not a big thing to ask. And so, and as part of a republic and a democracy, a republic, everyone is a democracy, in case there's any confusions about that. And that if we're going to have that, we need to be represented by the people that make up our constituency. And therefore, we need to prepare them adequately to do that work.
I don't want a toolbox full of hammers, right? I need a wide variety of different tools with different uses and different perspective. Like, and that's the thing. Like, if I have a diverse group of people working for me, I can really address things.
Yeah.
Probably sometimes in a more creative or more effective way.
Yeah.
Because I have different perspective.
Yep.
And, you know, time and time again, they look at companies that have a diverse workforce are more effective.
Yeah. So we talk a lot about cognitive diversity, right? The ability to get multiple perspectives into an emergent problem set. And you have to remember that this TeamCast is meant for folks that are making decisions in 300 seconds or less. And so you need access to as many different perspectives as quickly as possible, which gets back to that question of trust and cohesion you spoke about earlier. You got to get that. You have to be ready right away. People are afraid to speak up, or they're not speaking up, or everyone who does speak up is saying the same thing. All of those things are not helpful to you solving the problem, which is the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't want in leadership, I don't want a bunch of yes men.
Yeah.
Right. I don't want people who just agree because you're the leader that they're just going to say, I welcome the feedback. I welcome the other opposing opinions, other ideas.
So it's important. We're going to start to wrap up now. Mm-hmm. Usually ask folks is, if you think about the listeners, what we often end with is, what can people improve on Monday? And so as you think about your time, especially now where you're now, part of your job is to develop others, what are some strategies that you're finding successful in that context, or anything else that you think might be useful to someone's listening that can start Monday?
There you go.
Yeah.
So something like that. Yeah. So simple little thing.
Simple little thing.
You know what? I have been, having only been promoted back in February, I've been going through a extremely critical cycle for myself it's a different, very different position. It's not as active. I am bored. In terms of like I'm not running around as much as I used to. And I think the thing that has helped me is trying to maintain the focus of why it is I'm doing this, right? What is the core value of me that is making me want to do this work, right? And it's when I find that one of the things that helps me a lot, like having gone to the summit recently, those going to things like that refocus me, bring me back to what it is that made me want to do this in the first place. And I think it is just reaching into that spot and finding that and not losing touch with it.
Yeah.
Because in the turmoil and when things aren't like feeling like they're going right, sometimes it's easy to kind of forget that.
Yeah.
You know, what it was that brought you to it in the first place and that, you know, our larger mission and how critically important that is.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. And I think it's a great place to end. Just to paraphrase that in my own words, is that what I will often say to myself when I'm stuck is, what am I in service to right now? Am I in service to my laziness or my embarrassment or my shame or my guilt or my sloth or whatever? Or am I in service to something greater than myself, right? Like, and once I say those words in my head, I'm like, oh yeah, I just need to get back on track.
Oh yeah. No, I've caught myself recently being like this negative Nancy. People are like, how's it going? I was like, I hate it. I don't like it. You know, and I get caught up in this. I'm like, no, you know, I have to remember, you know, why it is that I was like, oh yeah, deputy is something I would actually do. Besides the fact of being, feeling the pressure of you need to do this. This needs to happen kind of thing. Right. It needs to be a woman to break through that point is to like, go back to that. Because it's very easy for me to slip down that slippery slope of like, negative talk.
Yeah, it's and I can imagine, you tell me, but I can only speak from my own experience, is that, you know, when I went from being Preston Klein to Dr. Preston Klein, there were some things that came with that I wouldn't have chosen for myself. I liked being with my friends just in the shoot house talking about learning. And all of a sudden people are like, I need you to go on stage and do this thing. And I'm like, I'd rather not. But it comes with the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there are personal preferences, and then there's the sort of burden of the duty or the responsibility that we have to own the whole thing. I just think, I don't know, I'm so excited for you, and I'm excited for the FDNY. And I think having somebody with your experience and is just amazing. And so I think there is a bunch of young people, young men and women, that are looking up and going, yeah, man, that's something I want to be involved in. And because you're there. So I think it's awesome. So thank you for being here. Thank you. I know we've spent years trying to get you on the show, and you're like, I have nothing to say. And clearly today that we disproved that. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Preston.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks again for coming to the Teamcast, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. For more information about the Mission Critical Team Institute, please go to www.missioncti.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. If you are a Mission Critical Team that wants more information on our courses, please reach out to our Director of Operations, Janice Jackson, at janice@missioncti.com. That's Janese at missionCTI.com. And once again, thank you, Janice, and thank you to Shelby Rowe Productions for helping us produce the Teamcast. Have a great day.